This is an ABC podcast.
Dr. Anne Ali is the federal member for Cowan, which is based in the northern suburbs of Perth. Anne is not a political lifer. She hasn't spent decades fighting her way up through the party machine. Her life has given her enough struggles to contend with already. Anne Ali enjoyed a classic 70s working class Australian suburb childhood, playing street cricket, playing Marco Polo in the pool, all of that. She was an academic overachiever, but when she finished school, her mum took her to Cairo in the expectation that Anne would meet a husband there. And she did meet a husband. But when they moved back to Australia, he turned out to be violent and unreliable. And at one point, Anne was bringing up her two lovely sons alone while holding down a job and studying at night. But gradually, her hard work paid off, and she became an academic. And after the September 11 attacks, Anne was distressed to find that Australian Muslims like her were constantly being asked to affirm and then reaffirm that they had nothing to do with terrorism. And this led her into becoming an international academic expert in counterterrorism and de-radicalisation. And she was invited to the Obama White House for a conference on violent extremism. In 2016, her life changed again when Anne Ali became the first Muslim Australian woman to be elected to federal parliament. She's written a classic Australian memoir, which is quite moving, but at times it made me snort with laughter, which was embarrassing because I was drinking a cup of tea at the time. Her book is called Finding My Place. Hello, Anne.
Hi, Richard.
What was the name you were born with, Cairo?
Okay, you ready? It's pretty long and quite convoluted. It's actually Azza Mahmoud Fawzi Ali Hassini Surugi.
Oh, I can say that. I just chose not to.
I'm sure.
What happened when you went to school in Australia? How did that go?
No, because you have to say Azza with this kind of guttural ah.
Azza.
Right. It's actually quite difficult to say, even for people who have the guttural ah. So I used to get called Azza. Azza. Azza.
Like Wazza.
Like Wazza.
Wazza. Azza.
Azza. And yeah, so it just got, nobody could pronounce my name. But now everyone can say cappuccino, can't they?
They can. So Anne was a lot easier in the end, was it?
I would go home in tears, mm-hmm. in tears, because nobody could pronounce my name correctly. And my sister had a relatively easy name to pronounce. She was Rhonda.
Oh, easy. Okay.
And my brother was Hussam, but people just called him Sam. My mum had changed her name to Sue, or she was used, you know, people called her Sue, and my dad people would call Mo. So I was the only one with the name that nobody ever could pronounce. So, yeah, eventually just my parents gave in and said, okay, change your name by deed poll and we'll call you Anne.
You're born in 1967 and born in Egypt. You've got a really beautiful and vivid description of Cairo in 1967 in your book. I'd just love you to read that to paint a picture of what Cairo was like when you were born.
Okay. Egypt, 1967. The blaring summer heat. Evening walks along Corniche and Nil. Ice-cold carob juice from a street vendor. The songs invoking a greater Arab homeland. Mohammed Hassanein Haykal's weekly column, Frankly, in the Akhbar al-Yom, or Daily News. The cries from women in their house dresses greeting the familiar clang of the gas bottle man. The taxi fare starting at a meagre 6 piastres. The Friday matinee at the cinema metro. The voice of the Arabs radio, Abdul Halim Hafiz. The Muslim Brotherhood, Gamal Abdel Nasser and Arab nationalism. The fading promise of a better Egypt. If the 1960s symbolised the era of making love, not war, of blowing in the wind, the Beatles, liberation and hope, it was not the world that greeted my arrival.
Yeah, this is the year 1967. This is the year, the year of the Six-Day War.
Absolutely.
So this means that your generation was known as the children of the Naxa. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's quite an interesting phrase because it wasn't a phrase that I was familiar with, having left Egypt shortly after 1967 when I was very, very young. But I came across this phrase 40 years on, like the 40th anniversary of the Naxa. And the Naxa is the colloquial name. It literally means the setback. It's the colloquial name given to the Six-Day War, which was a devastating defeat of the Egyptian and United Arab armies at the Sinai. And it really marked a period. I mean, even the name given to it, the Naxa, speaks to the way in which time is marked by conflict in the Middle East and in Egypt. So that whole generation of people born in 1967 wear this kind of marking, and I describe it as kind of like a birthmark on our foreheads, that we're known as the children of the Naksa. We are the generation of the setback.
The setback. So that means disappointment.
Disappointment.
The change as well? Disappointment. Change as well?
I think more disappointment than change. I think there was this, before the Six-Day War, as Arab troops gathered in the Sinai, there was this swelling of anticipation that the Arab armies were going to defeat the Israeli army because they were so much bigger in numbers. But when the Arab armies were in fact defeated, it was a huge humiliation and a huge disappointment.
Because they were caught on the hop, weren't they? Because Israel acted preemptively and ahead of the hostilities and got in first.
They did, right, yeah. And they came in from behind, mm-hmm. essentially. And even though their army was so outnumbered by the Arab forces, they managed to win this war, and Egypt and the Arab armies retreated in what was a very, very humiliating defeat.
Where did your family fit into the class structure of Cairo and Egypt back in those days?
Extremely middle class. We probably were the definition of the working middle class in Egypt. Egypt is a very class-based society. You have your really, really rich and you're really, really poor, and then you have this massive middle class that are very well educated, but for all intents and purposes, quite struggling. Not unlike much of Australia, I imagine, in contemporary Australia. So very middle class. Dad was an engineer. Mum was a nurse. Lived in a pretty middle class suburb, and dealt with these kinds of. I've always said of Egypt that in terms of morality and the morals and traditions, the rich don't need them.
No.
And the poor can't afford them. So they are very much a middle-class thing, all of the middle-class morality.
Yeah, it sounds like 19th century Britain in that way. The upper class do what they like.
Yep.
The lower class do what they like. Yep. But the middle class, they're more morally upright. They observe, they're more religious, go to the mosque, do all the right things and look respectable.
Very much so.
So the appearance of respectability is important.
And honour.
Your mum's family were from a town on the Nile. It's called Minya. What was that place like?
El Minya is about 200 kilometres south of Cairo in what's called the Sa'id. And the Sa'id in Egypt is Upper Egypt, but it's the south, so I don't know how that works. It is complicated. But the Sa'id in Egypt is very, very rural. It's kind of like country bumpkins versus city slickers. So Cairo is kind of the city slickers, and the Sa'id, Minya, and the surrounding areas are kind of like the country bumpkins.
Is that a bit like the rural town city divide in Australia?
Very much like the rural town city divide. Very, very conservative. Extremely conservative, but also a very large Christian population as well, larger than the major cities.
So your mum grew up alongside Coptic Christians.
She went to a Christian school and a Francophone school, and it was at a time where walking down the streets of Minya, you would greet a sheikh and a priest with the same deference. You know, there was very much this unity of a nationalist unity. You know, we're all Egyptians. And this sectarian divide between Christian and Muslim really, really didn't exist.
So your mum was a nurse. She met your dad,
mm-hmm.
and you were daughter number two.
And
I like this description of your arrival here. You say, every family has a golden child, the one who is quiet, sleeps through the night, toilet trains early, obeys every command, and who attracts the oohs and ahs of strangers in shopping centres. I was not that child. What child were you then,
No,
Anne?
I was the devilish one. Actually, I've actually got these photos of me and my sister, and in every single photo, she's got this angelic smile. There's almost like this halo, this glow around her. And there's me with some kind of scowl on my face. And, I look back at those photos and a lot, it really does explain a lot, actually. I was the black sheep, pretty much, from birth.
What made your parents want to come to Australia and leave behind everything they'd known in the old country?
Yeah, I think, Egypt, we had the setback of 1967, the Naksa, and it was very clear that Arab nationalism had really failed Egypt in terms of actually delivering something to that huge burgeoning middle class. You had the kind of the more urbanisation of the rural parts with the the nationalism in Alexandria, which is where my parents were living, a lot of the cosmopolitan parts of Alexandria changed. You had the Greeks were expelled, the Maltese were expelled, and in their place you had rural people from rural areas coming into Alexandria. So Egypt was really changing. The face of Egypt was really changing.
It's becoming more conservative, I suppose, in that way. And as a result, so your parents just got a bit pessimistic about Egypt's future at that point and wanted to leave?
I think also there was the opportunities that countries like Australia were offering. So they applied for immigration to Australia and Canada, and Australia came through first. So they ended up, you know, accepting the first offer. And this was at a time when Australia was just opening its doors to non-Western European immigrants. So they were one of the first Egyptian families, actually, to come to Australia.
So once they landed in Australia, what kind of work did your parents get?
They landed at Bonegilla, and I know there's probably many listeners out there who have some kind of connection with Bonegilla, which was a migrant training camp in Albury, Wodonga. And they stayed there for 40 days with a they did English classes, and they were given $3 a week, weekly allowance. And then my father was given a job at a factory in Sydney. And so he went ahead and got a room, just a room for us, rooming with some Greeks, because my parents were always around Greeks growing up or living in Alexandria. Got a room for us with some Greeks. And my mother followed a few days later with my sister and I. We both had measles, she tells me.
So your dad was working in a factory and got other kinds of work, but he was trained as an engineer. Was it the life he imagined for himself when he came here?
Absolutely not. And I think that's a very common trait in a lot of the immigrant stories. You have people coming here, coming to Australia who are incredibly well qualified in their countries of origin. And they come to Australia and they end up doing tasks like my father ended up being a bus driver. My mother was a nurse's aide, originally started working in the factory, then nurse's aide, and then retrained as a nurse here in Australia as a registered nurse. But you hear this a lot with the migrant story. I mean, you get into a cab and, you know, the taxi driver may well have a medical degree from his country of origin. Very, very typical migrant story.
You landed in Brisbane, and in West End in Brisbane, inner city
West
Brisbane.
End,
yeah.
Yes.
How much did you want your family to be like the Brady Bunch, Anne?
Oh my gosh, the Brady Bunch were like my touchstone to what it meant to be a typical Western family, because we were so not like that. And I would watch the Brady Bunch and I would see, my goodness, these people like actually talk to their children about punishments instead of throwing shoes at them, which is what my parents did.
How good a shot was your mum with the shoe? Anyway.
She was pretty good. That woman would qualify for Olympic gold if she tried. I tell you, she was pretty good. She couldn't throw a ball, but a shoe coming at you like a precision guided missile anytime.
But of course, no one's family is like the Brady Bunch. And as someone observed in the Brady Bunch movie, not once in that house do you ever see a toilet anywhere in that house, do you?
No.
So they don't even go to the toilet in the Brady Bunch. So I don't know. Did it take you long to realise that?
What's really interesting about the Brady Bunch is actually for its time, here is a story about a blended family. They were not typical. They were very atypical. And the producers of the Brady Bunch actually had to make Mr. and Mrs. Brady widows, divorced,
right,
to fit in with the kind of cultural expectations and the social expectations and social norms of the time. But the fact that they were actually quite atypical was completely lost on me as a child. It's only now looking back that I think, oh, wow, no wonder I was so drawn to it, because they weren't a normal family.
You were living in West End in Brisbane when the 74 floods hit Brisbane. Mm. I wasn't there for that, but I was there for the more recent ones.
Mm.
What do you remember of the 74 floods? Because they came into West End, those floods, didn't they?
They did. They certainly did. We lost pretty much everything. And what I remember most about that was the generosity of the people who became lifelong friends for my family, the people from the churches who took us in, who fed us, who clothed us, who helped us regain some of what we lost, and were a permanent fixture in our lives from then on.
West End was pretty multicultural, Greek and Italian in those days. Where did you fit into that scheme of things, Anne?
Yeah, I've always been the outsider. I've become comfortable with being the outsider, actually, Richard. Too dark to be Greek or Italian. Not wog enough, but too wog in many regards. So I was basically called the blackie
The Blackie.
The Blackie. A lot of people thought I was Aboriginal.
Right. Did that create problems for you?
Huge problems. But it's actually given me a real insight into you know, the lives of Indigenous young people and the kinds of racism and structural barriers they could have. But yeah, my best friend in year two, Maria herself, of immigrant stock, Greek, just one day just stopped talking to me.
Why?
Wouldn't be my friend. I had no idea. And I remember just spending the whole day following her saying, why aren't you talking to me? Why aren't you talking to me? And it was at the end of the day when her cousin turned to me and said, listen, Blackie, she's not allowed to be your friend anymore. So stop talking to her. And I just remember thinking, but I'm not black. Her parents had seen me and presumed that I was Aboriginal and so banned their daughter from being my friend.
Oh, that's mad.
Isn't
it? That's awful too.
Isn't
it? And they're migrants.
And do you know what, Richard? A lot of people I speak to say, oh, you know, it's all about educating. It's all about educating the children. And my response to that is I've never had a six-year-old tell me they don't like me because of the colour of my skin or my religion, but I've had their parents tell me that. So it's not about educating the children. It's about educating the adults.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you don't. Hitler's Germany was the most educated population in the world at the time, pretty much.
That's right.
So I don't know about that education line either. I think.
No. You know, people always think that you know doing something to it's the kids. It's the kids. It's the kids. No. It's the adults in this case.
Your parents both working hard meant that you and your siblings were spending a lot of time after school alone.
Yep. Typical latchkey kids.
Latchkey kids. Now, this carries over into your adult life when you have two sons, when you're a single mum. How would you try and catch up on your teenage sons when they were at home after school?
I devised what I call creative parenting techniques. And among my creative parenting techniques was this little kind of scenario that I used to play with the boys where I said to them, right, if I'm not home and somebody rings home, don't tell them mum's not home, right? Stranger danger and all of that. So what you need to do is you need to say to them, mum's just in the shower and she'll call you back. Then you need to call me at work and then I will call that person as if I'd just gotten out of the shower. Okay, mum. So I'd test them. So I'd ring them up and I'd pretend to be Mrs. Maguire. You know, Mrs. Maguire would sound like this. Okay. Hello? Is mum home? Where's your mum? Can you put your mum on the phone for me? And every time they would say to me, mum, we know it's you. And I kind of thought, geez, these kids are smart. But then I figured out Mrs. Maguire only has one voice and one name. So they probably figured out it was me. But I remember.
What's that accent, by the way?
It's Pauline Hanson.
Is it Pauline Hanson accent? What is that? It
does sound like Pauline Hanson, though, doesn't it?
But hello. It's Mrs. Maguire here.
Hello, it's Mrs. Maguire.
Oh, have you cut the tea and a sandwich?
Yeah. And then one time I remember ringing and pretending to be Mrs. Maguire. And the boys were like, mum, we know it's you. Mum, can you please stop doing this? And I said, you very rude boys. And I hung up the phone. Then I said to my colleague, my son's going to ring any minute now. Tell him that I'm in a meeting and I've been in the meeting for the last hour. So she did that. I then eventually rang back my son and I said, what's up? And he goes, oh, mother, I've done something terrible. Somebody rang for you and I thought it was you. So I told them to stop. But actually it wasn't you. And I'm saying, see, this is why you should always listen to your mother.
To your mother. That's right.
Creative parenting.
So, I don't know, school was always problematic. It sounds like at times you had a pretty marvellous time, but other times not so great. Mm. Your chief tormentor in primary school was, and this is in Sydney, by the time you found him after Sydney, was a girl called Christine. Tell me about Christine and her sidekick, Silent Iris.
Christine. You know, everyone's got a childhood nemesis that features like throughout their life. Every time you picture, like if you do boxing and you have to punch something, There's Christine. She just, as soon as I started at Belmore North Primary School, she took it upon herself to be my tormentor because she hated Muslims and Silent Iris, her little sidekick, hated Muslims too. So I thought, wow, you live in Lekemba. You've got a lot of hating to do. You know, how do you find the time to hate so much? So obviously she had to take her hating into the schoolyard and she would just she would just walk past me and kick me, or walk past me and whisper something horrible to me, or send me little notes in class telling me I'm going to go to hell, or, you know.
Oh, so this was a religious thing then? This wasn't.
It was completely about my religion, completely about my religion. And then one time, she came up to me in the playground and she said, "Do you believe in Jesus?" And I thought, God, here we go. Christine's at it again. And I didn't quite know how to answer because, you know, religion wasn't something that we talked about very much in my family. There was this kind of assumption that, yeah, we were Muslim and it was part of our tradition and our culture, but I didn't do religious lessons. If anything, my parents sent me to Sunday school because they thought that's where you learn maths and English and you get extra tuition.
And Jesus is an honored prophet in Islam anyway, but complicated.
My parents sent me to Sunday school thinking that I was going to get more maths and English, and then I came home with pictures of Jesus and they realized what Sunday school was. But... yeah, so we never really talked about it at home. And then she said, no, you don't believe in Jesus. You're a dirty Muslim and you're going to go to hell. My mother says you are. And she spat at me.
What, on your face?
Right at my face. And I thought, right, that's it. So I took my little self down to the teacher and walked into the teacher's room and she said, what do you want? And I told her what happened and she looked at me and she rolled her eyes and she said, oh, don't be so stupid. And when I protested and said, you know, you should do something about this. It's not right what she did. She threatened to send me to the principal's office. And because I was such a goody two shoes who was really scared of going to the principal's office, I kind of retreated. But I do remember telling my mum about that incident later that evening. And she was all sorts of angry. She marched into the school the next day. And her biggest thing was, putting the teacher in a corner saying, how dare you call my daughter stupid? You know she's your top student. Yeah, she's not stupid.
Oh, she's not stupid.
Right. She was so much more offended by that than anything else. But for me, it was a real eye-opener because I thought it was that point in your life, and I think everyone has this point in their life where you realise that the world isn't perfectly ordered into the good guys and the bad guys, and the good guys get, you know, the bad guys always lose out and the good guys always win, that...
You have an expectation of justice.
You do.
And then you don't get it.
And the people who you expect to bring you justice, who you rely on to bring you justice, the adults of this world, don't bring you justice. And you know, there has to be a reason why 50 years on, well, maybe not 50, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves, 40 years on, this still plays a significant role. Role in my kind of my life and I can point to it as a significant event in my life and that pointed me in a particular direction.
That teaches one thing. What about Christine and Silent Iris? Where are they today? Do you know?
I've got no idea. I've got no idea. She probably lives. I don't know. I have no idea where Christine and Silent. Needless to say, we didn't become the best of friends and meet up again at high school or primary school reunions.
There's no happy ending to that.
No.
You moved out to the outer burbs of Sydney, new house, new school again, Chipping Norton, though, mixed suburb this time. It sounds like you had the kind of classic Australian suburban childhood there with street cricket, like I said. And do you have rules for street cricket? Like, you know, if the dog catches it, you're out, that kind of thing, or if it hits the fence, that kind of thing?
We kind of changed the rules to suit ourselves most of the time.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they were great times. And, you know, and you had the tin bins back then. You didn't have these big plastic bins. You had the tin bins and they'd be your wickets. And you'd play it in the driveway and, you'd stop for passing cars and, you know, right into the heat of summer where, the tarmac would be melting and, you know, my skin had turned virtually really, really dark black by the end of the summer, being out there playing street cricket.
And when you bowl someone out, the lid would come off the bin.
And you'd all yell out. You'd stand with your feet hip length apart, and you'd arms up in the air and how's that? whenever you got a run, they were fantastic times. And it didn't matter who you were, and it didn't matter where you came from. It didn't matter what language you spoke at home. It didn't matter what religion you were. It didn't matter what skin colour you were. You all played cricket.
You formed a friendship, a really close friendship, with a girl called Tracy. How close was that friendship with her and her family too?
Extremely close. Once I'd grown out of the kind of Brady Bunch phase, Tracy's family became my touchstone for what a true Aussie family was. And there were things that they did that I thought, you know, this is what Australian families do. Why doesn't my family do that? Like, you know, they go to restaurants. My family never goes to restaurants because my dad was always like, why I go to restaurants? Your mother, she cook for me. And I actually went to my very first restaurant with Tracy and her family. The Black Stump.
Oh, right. That was a good night out back in the 70s, wasn't it?
Back in those days, you could order really exotic food like spaghetti bolognese. It was the very first time I went to a restaurant. They went to movies together. And that was the first time I went to the movies with the family. They did stuff that I wish that my parents and my family would do. They went away for weekends. We never went away for weekends.
Yeah. So that experience is what gives you the sense of Australianness in a way?
It did. In that, Tracy and her family represented to me everything that my family weren't. And to me, they were the quintessential Australian family. And I thought, you know, why can't my family be more like that? Why don't we do those things? Because if we did those things, maybe I'd be more Australian and people wouldn't keep calling me Wog.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler.
We were talking before about your friendship. Your best friend in school in Sydney was a girl, Tracy. It was only later on in life, when you tried to make contact with her, that her brother sent you an email saying that it turned out she'd been sexually abused by her father all that time.
Yeah, all those years when I was looking at this family and thinking, wow, you know, the dad tells this affable character who tells jokes, the mum gets perms, this is the quintessential, this is the ideal Aussie family. And it was many, many years later that I got an email from her brother, you know, asking me if I was the same Anne Alley who grew up in Chipping Norton. And her brother and my brother were best friends as well. And then he told me, he said, I'm not sure if I should tell you this, but I suppose it's out in the open now. But Dad's in jail. He was sexually abusing Tracy from the age of 6. And I cried for days. For days and days, I just thought, how did I not know? You know, this girl and I, we went through puberty together. We went to our first concert together, Kiss. We went to the first Kiss concert together. We did everything together. How could I not see how much pain my dear, dear friend was in? It was devastating to me. It was like being told that Santa Claus wasn't real. You know, Tracy came and stayed with us, came to WA and stayed with us over a weekend. We reconnected. She hadn't changed at all, actually. And at the end of that weekend, I could tell there was something on her mind for the whole weekend. And at the end of that weekend, she asked me, she said, did my dad ever abuse you? And it came to light that she'd been pretty much connecting with everyone from her childhood, trying to find out if her father had abused any one of her friends.
Maybe you were some kind of refuge. Your friendships were some kind of way of being a normal girl.
I think, you know, when her brother sent me that email, he said, you know, we have very fond memories of your house and, you know, eating at your house and dinner at your house. It was the place that we felt safe. And at first I was quite confused by that. And then when he told me what kind of abuser his father was, that all kind of made sense.
So you thought that they were the quote-unquote normal house and they saw your house
as the refuge.
As the normal house.
The normal refuge, the safe place where they could be who they wanted to be and who they needed to be.
You were sort of blossoming into womanhood, to use a terrible cliche, at the same time. Tell me how your mum explained blossoming into womanhood. I'm putting that in inverted commas here. Tell me how your mum explained the birds and the bees to you, please, Anne.
Well, see, blossoming is a very apt word actually there, Richard, because she had this way of explaining it to us. Arabic is a very flowery language and it doesn't always translate very well into English. And so my mother's translation of the kind of birds and the bees talk when something like this. The woman, she's like a flower. The man, he like to smell the flower. So the man, he smelled the flower once, twice, three times, and then the flower, she no smell good anymore. He throw it away. He find another flower. And that was it.
So
that was it.
So is the point then to put a peg on the man's nose, maybe? Or
I don't know what I thought it was coded script for the art of flower arranging. Took me a while to figure out that it was actually the talk. And once I figured that out, then we had great fun with my mother making fun about men with big noses. She wasn't very appreciative of our sense of humour, though.
So you're an academic overachiever. Like I said, you got top marks at school. You earned a place at Sydney Uni Law School, but your mum wanted to come with you, come with her to Cairo to find you a husband, pretty much?
Pretty much. So it was on my final, the day after my final exams, my parents basically said, you're going to Egypt. And, you know, they made it sound that it was going to be a holiday, but I knew very well that it wasn't going to be a holiday. My sister had since married and her husband moved her back to Egypt. So she was living in Egypt. And I think my parents saw that this kind of what was supposed to be a temporary stay in Australia was coming towards its end. They'd been in Australia 14, 15 years, no contact with family in Egypt. We'd never had anyone come and visit us except one auntie. And so I think they thought, you know, now it's time for us to move back. And this actually happens with a lot of migrant families. They decide that they'll move back. But the Egypt that they were returning to wasn't the Egypt that they had left. It was a completely different place. And they'd grown accustomed to Australia. Australia was home. But it took that trip to Egypt for them to realise that. So basically got packed up, went to Egypt. We went and stayed with my auntie who I'd never met and my five cousins who I'd never met. And then after about a month, my mum said, well, you're staying, I'm going. And that was it.
So that's when you studied at the American University in Cairo, did an arts degree there. And for a while there, you almost sort of got right into the life and became a kind of an Egyptian young woman in Cairo for a bit.
I didn't really have much choice, Richard. You know, it was, I've always been kind of pragmatic and thought, okay, well, this is the situation you're given. I've kind of had to be that way, I guess, in my life. This is the situation you're given. How do you work it? How do you work with this situation that you're given? So I went to the American University in Cairo, and the American University Cairo is such an elite institution. And it was so alien to me because I'd come from such working class roots, working class background in Egypt, working class background in Australia. And here I was plunged into the elite world where my classmate was Princess Rania of Jordan. She wasn't a princess then, but she was
up there in the royal
pretty,
family.
Pretty up there, right, yeah. And they were all, you know, people whose parents were ambassadors and, you know, these were old money.
And you were Lady Anne Ali of Chipping Norton.
I was the Aussie chick who, right. I used to go to uni in track pants and you know, they were all dressed to the nines and I thought, oh gosh, I better start to fit in here.
That's where you met your first husband there. Mm. And you got married pretty quick after that, didn't you?
Five weeks. Well, it was, It wasn't an arranged marriage, but my parents from the age of, well, as soon as I moved to Egypt, had a constant flow, shall we say, of suitors in an attempt to marry me off.
And yeah, it was like half of Cairo was involved in trying to find your husband.
That's pretty much how it works. And I'd managed to dodge every single one by making up stories about them. Poor guys. But this one was someone of my own choosing, and within 5 weeks we were married.
Once you moved back to Australia, you settled in Perth, and it turned out he was quite a violent man.
Yes.
And abusive man. Disappear on you for days.
Days on end.
Days on end and all of that. And that's when you were in that situation. You've been this kind of strong, confident woman, an overachiever, and you still felt you couldn't leave. That's that classic thing, isn't it?
It is so classic that, you know, yeah, I think as well, Richard, for me, a lot of my overachieving was always felt like I wasn't good enough. And so when you feel like you're not good enough, it can either make you or it can break you. It can make you turn you into an overachiever or it can just break you completely. And it kind of turned me into this kind of overachiever who always wanted to prove that I could do it. I can do this. I can do this. I'm better than this. I'm better than that.
But that's brittle. That was a brittle form of self-confidence.
Very much so. And I do to this day still think that leaving him was the hardest thing I ever had to do, because I had two children, because of this constant kind of guilt. This guilt that I couldn't make it work. I wasn't patient enough. I wasn't strong enough. I wasn't good enough to make my marriage work.
He wasn't paying bills or helping you, and left you with a mortgage and two sons to bring up.
Left me with a lot, and I ended up having to go on welfare.
What was it like to ask for that?
Oh, extremely, extremely devastating, extremely humiliating. And I remember walking into the DSS, as it was called back then. It was this horrible grey structure with this horrible grey worn carpet and just a collective of miserable souls, it seemed. And sitting there with my boys and the gentleman there saying, you know, you'll have to wait five weeks for a payment. And I just said to him, I've got nothing. I've got nothing. How do I feed my children? And he said, isn't there somebody who can help you? And I said, no, because the last thing my family was going to support me in was a divorce, and particularly a divorce of my own making. And I just walked out of there, turned the corner and leaned back on the wall and broke down, completely broken.
Does a moment like that stand you in good stead for politics?
I think it does. I think it gives you a kind of an empathy that, you know how hard it is. You know what it means to do it hard. You know what it means to be that person who has to put half their shopping back at the checkout because you just don't have enough money, or, you know, to wonder how you're going to feed your children and pay the bills and pay the mortgage. I hope that it does. It's certainly something that's never left me. And, you know, you can go on and become all of these great things and do great things, but there's always a little part of you. I describe it kind of like a little crack in a bone somewhere, a little part of you that's always broken, and you carry that with you in your life. But it's also an incredible sense or an incredible source of strength as well, this little bit of you that's broken.
So there you were, bringing up two sons in the burbs of Perth, holding down a job and studying frantically at night. Wow.
Studying at night. So I'd put the boys to bed, study all night, get a few hours sleep, wake up in the morning and do it all over again, because I thought, you know, I've got to get this done. I was doing a master's at that time, and I've got to finish my master's. I've got to get this done so I can start providing better for my boys.
What were you thinking the night of the September 11 attacks in 2001 on the World Trade Center in Washington?
It's, I think everyone's got a story of where they were.
Yeah.
I was at home watching television, and then these images come on TV, and I thought, is this the next Bruce Willis blockbuster? And I just remember sitting down and going, oh my gosh, this is terrible. Oh my gosh, this can't be happening. This can't be real. And then my thoughts turning to the perpetrators, as I imagine everybody's thoughts would turn to the perpetrators, and just thinking, oh gosh, I hope it's not Muslims.
What did it mean for Muslim women to be doing the shopping after those attacks, when it was indeed found to have been Al-Qaeda?
Things changed really, really quickly, and it was like Muslims were like statues in a room that suddenly came to life, and the gaze turned onto these people. And at one point I was out doing the shopping, and there was a Muslim woman there with hijab, and this mother and her daughter, and it was like a scene out of Animal Kingdom, you know. They were praying on her, they were following her through the aisles, and then they pounced on her and started yelling abuse at her, and walked away with these big smiles on their faces, and the mother patting the daughter's back like they'd done their service to Australia.
Christine and Silent Iris again, was it?
Absolutely. Yeah. But the sense of pride on this woman's face, I'll never forget the look on this woman's face as her daughter was yelling abuse at this woman. And I just thought, wow, this is what Australia's become.
So that was that kind of real, this is us and them, that environment. What did you feel like at that time? Did you feel, someone who's grown up in Australia, spent nearly all her life in Australia, with an Australian accent, did you feel like you were on a side or not on a side? Were you us or them, or them inside us? Or where did you place yourself in that?
It's really interesting because, you know, a lot of the other people that I've spoken to, perhaps I didn't feel it as acutely as women who wear the hijab, for example, or as young men. young Muslim men felt it. But there was certainly this sense that, you know, wait a minute, I've always been one of you. I've always been us. And now suddenly I'm them. And, you know, especially when, because I don't appear Muslim in any kind of overt way, there's not anything conspicuous about it. But once people who I'd known found out that I was Muslim, their attitudes would completely change. And it was quite telling to me how somebody could change upon knowing one part of you that was not significant to the relationship that you had with them, that was not impactful on the relationship that you had with them, but that once they found out you're Muslim, they could completely turn around.
You decided to do a PhD at uni in counterterrorism or in radicalisation, I suppose.
Yeah, well, my PhD was more about wanting to understand why people think about terrorism the way that they think about terrorism. I wanted to know, you know, where do we get these ideas of what terrorism is and how does it impact on our everyday? How does it impact on our behaviours? It fed into Australia's first metric of fear, where we looked at behavioural responses to fear, to the fear of terrorism. You know, were people taking on protective or avoidance behaviours in response to this this thing called terrorism that was now really pretty much pervasive in our media, in our political dialogue, in the way that we talked about Muslims, in the way that we talked about the Middle East and Arab countries, and in the way that we talked about ourselves as well. So these were the kinds of things that I wanted to explore.
What kind of people were you talking to in that process?
I spoke to a lot of young Muslims and older Muslims as well, and I spoke to a lot of broader community Australians. And it was really, you know, it was quite... with the young Muslims that I spoke to, you know, this whole thing of, you know, once we were them and now we're not. You know, once I was Australian and that was all I ever was and that's all I ever was brought up to be and that's all I ever considered myself, and now I'm constantly being told I'm not Australian. There was a sense of loss, a real sense of loss.
But at the same time, you were conscious of radicalising preachers within the community as well.
Yeah.
What do you learn about that process of radicalisation?
It's really interesting because I've spoken to a lot of people who have left that behind, people who have walked away from terrorism, who have walked away from violent extremism, walked away from white supremacist groups and former foreign fighters as well. And you know, one of them described it to me. He said, you know, Anne, I've always been an activist. This is a former foreign fighter. He travelled to Afghanistan and fought in that war or in that battle. And he says, I've always been an activist. Now he works in a different kind of activism, he says. Now he works in de-radicalising young people. He says, now it's just a different kind of activism. And you learn a lot about how young people or even older people can be influenced, but also the commonalities that are used, whether it's a white supremacist group, a violent jihadist group, the kinds of narrative structure and the things that they use to appeal and influence to people in order to bring them into the fold and change their worldviews are very, very similar.
It seems to me that the things they have in common is that with young jihadists particularly, is that they'll find some guy will sidle up alongside them and say, that Islam your father practices, that's not real Islam.
Absolutely.
Just going to the church here, you know, going to the mosque, that's not real Islam. And what they offer them is, one, a grievance and a real rock-solid moral structure that appeals to their sense of honour, perversely so. And that can be also true for white supremacists as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that the underlying or the basis of it is the us and them. That has to be the start of it. You are part of us and they are them. And then comes in the grievance. We are under attack by them, or, you know, they are taking things away from us. And then there's a kind of a moral superiority. We're better than them. And then you get the dehumanization of them. The cockroach syndrome. They are cockroaches.
Yeah.
They are vermin. We need to eradicate them. And that's where it tips over to violence, or the propensity for violence.
So now you're a doctor, you became Dr. Anne Ali, invited all over the world. Went to a conference at the Obama White House where you nearly died of the cold just waiting to get into the White House.
Nearly died of hypothermia.
Because you'd never seen snow before.
Yeah. People keep telling me, oh, Anne, you need to see snow. Like, it's cold, it's wet. What do I need to see it for?
And how can you have a doctorate and not know that snow is cold? I just don't know. I don't understand that.
Oh, I know. But my doctorate wasn't in snow.
Right, okay. Right. So, turns out snow's cold. Anyway, nonetheless, you do all these amazing things. And you've also, around about this time, kind of sort of, this lovely man. That you're married to now, Dave Allen. How did you meet him?
So I met Dave ages ago, actually. We were working in the same place, but we were both married to different people, and it wasn't until about 8 years later I get this email from, oh, la-di-da-di, Dr. Anne Alley, oh, la-di-da-di, counterterrorism. Yeah, he'd moved on and I'd moved on anyway. We met up and, you know, how are things for you? Oh, terrible, I'm getting a divorce. What about you? Oh, yeah, I'm getting a divorce too. So, as this saying goes, it was just the right time, right place, and a couple of years later, we were married.
How does he go with you inviting white supremacists over for dinner all the time? How does he go with that? Does he mind all that?
Well, he works in intelligence and security. So, he's a little bit like Liam Neeson. I will find you. I have skills. So when I invited a former white supremacist. Come on, give me a bit of credit.
She was an academic and a member of parliament. One day she was taken. I could see that movie. So, like I say, you had this really interesting life. You're addressing the United Nations in Geneva, going to the White House, giving all this policy advice. So when the Labor Party in WA rang you and said, we want you to run for Parliament, you said yes. Why did you give away that life to go to Canberra?
Question I ask myself every day, Richard. Mm-hmm. I did have this fantastic career, and I was travelling around and doing all sorts of really great things. I was a professor. I'd been to the White House. I'd been to the Club de Madrid, which sadly is not a disco, the United Nations. But I remember, you know, it was a cold November night in Vienna, and I walked out of the United Nations building after 3 days of talks. And I'd 3 weeks earlier been in Madrid at the Club de Madrid for 2 days of talks. And I walked out of there, and the sky was grey, and somewhere in the background, the Christmas marketers were setting up their markets, and Dave was waiting for me on the steps, and you could see his breath in the cold air, and he took my hands and started warming them up, and he said to me, are you done? And I said, I'm actually really done. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, all this talk and all of these dialogues that I go to, and I'm going to go home to Australia and nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to change because there's no political will. And, you know, you can call it serendipity, or you can call it destiny, or you could call it fate. But it was on the way home from there, we stopped off in Bali to thaw out from the winter cold. And I was lying by the pool and my phone rang. I didn't answer it because I didn't know the number. And then I got this text message saying, it's WA Labor, give us a call. And I thought, what do they want with me? I was never political. So I rang my son, who was young Labor. And the conversation literally went like this, Richard. Oh, hi, Adam, it's Mum. Oh, hi, Mum, what's up? I said, you know, I've just got this text from WA Labor. They want to meet with me. What do you think that's about? Oh, I don't know, Mum. Maybe they want you to run in the next election. There's an election? When? I didn't even know there was an election. But, you know, I asked them the same question. I said, I've got this great career. I'm doing all of these great things. I've reached the pinnacle of my career. Why should I do this? And the response was, because it would be a different way to make change. And that's all I needed.
Is that true? I know you're only just starting your second term in Parliament, and you're a backbencher, and no one just walks into the Parliament and runs the joint.
Yeah.
And you're in opposition too. But do you see yourself over time having influence?
I think there is a level of influence that comes with being a politician. I see that the greatest change that I'm making is the changes in small ways to people's everyday lives, to the people who walk into my office or call my office, who need help with Centrelink or you know, with immigration or with those issues. In many ways, change is incremental. All change is incremental. And it is those small changes. Well, for me, they're small. They're small things that I do. But for the people that that they have a huge impact for these people. So I see that that's probably, and it's probably the way I feel most comfortable about making change. I think there are a lot of changes that still need to be made. So I'm not quite ready to give them up yet. I think the more diversity that we have in our parliament, the more that change is going to come.
A fellow WA backbencher, Andrew Hastie, is having an impact from his background in the SAS on national security issues and all that sort of things. Do you see yourself having a role like that in parliamentary committees and the like, speaking up like that?
I'd like to, but there are challenges to that, and those challenges are that, you know, politics is not a meritocracy, and you don't necessarily always get put into the area where you can make the most contribution. So like anything in my life, I guess I've just got to keep finding my place.
Yeah. So it's a hell of a thing to get elected to federal parliament.
Sure is.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to laugh at politicians, but it's really quite an honour to enter federal parliament.
An incredible honour and an incredibly, incredibly humbling experience, I think, as well, to think that there are so many people who put their faith in you, and the last thing that you want to do is let all of those people down and not deliver and not be the kind of person that they want you to be and the kind of person that they need you to be.
Fascinating speaking with you, Anne. I really enjoyed it. It's been such
Me
a pleasure.
Too.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Richard.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
I spoke with Dr. Anne Ali in 2019. Anne's book is called Finding My Place. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hi, Sarah here. I'd like to let you know about an excellent new podcast from the ABC, Patient Zero. Patient Zero is like a true crime thriller, but for disease outbreaks. Each episode starts with a mystery illness before joining the teams that trace these deadly diseases back to their origins. You'll learn where these outbreaks begin, why they happen, and how we found ourselves in the middle of a really big one. Here's a taste.
We're living through a pretty surreal moment in history. A pandemic the likes of which the world hasn't seen before, or at least in 100 years.
I got a phone call saying, we've got somebody from Wuhan and they've got fever and cough. What do you think about this?
It was basically declaring the state of emergency for the whole country. That was the scariest moment.
So, how exactly did we get here?
Anybody who is surprised by what we're going through right now hasn't been paying attention to what scientists have been telling us for over 30 years.
I'm Olivia Willis, and this is Patient Zero, a new series about disease outbreaks and how we found ourselves in the middle of a really big one. Each week, we'll join the teams who track down the source of outbreaks, figuring out where they begin, why they happen, and what they can tell us about ourselves.
Scientists were trying to figure out, you know, on the fly, what is this virus? How does it spread? Can it be spread asymptomatically? You know, where did it come from? All of these questions.
Join us as we travel around the world and back in time to tell stories of disease outbreaks and the people who stood witness to their origins. Patient Zero is a production of ABC Science and Radio National.
Every outbreak is an opportunity to learn something new about the disease at hand. Outbreaks are a combination of an infectious agent and the social situation in which they find themselves.
Search RN Presents Patient Zero in the ABC Listen app, or wherever you get your podcasts.